Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Zach Soler, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology, Head, and Neck Surgery at the Medical University of South Carolina. They will discuss the article Perspective, Multicenter Evaluation of Balloon Sinus Dilation for Treatment of Pediatric Chronic Rhinosinusitis.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm Dr. Tim Smith, your host, and I'm glad to be joined by Dr. Zach Soler at the Medical University of South Carolina. We're going to be discussing his article. It's currently available on Early View, and it's entitled Prospective Multicenter Evaluation of Balloon Sinus Dilation for the Treatment of Pediatric Chronic Rhinosinusitis. Zach, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I was really looking forward to having you on the podcast because the topic is so timely, I think. It's pretty clear that balloon sinus dilation is of great interest around the country. And I also feel like pediatric sinusitis, the management of it, is just less studied than adult sinusitis. So it's nice to see some advances in the pediatric realm. I think the topic's really timely and of great interest, and look forward to talking to you about this. Let's first talk a little bit about the funding of the study and potential conflicts of interest that are involved. The study was paid for by one of the companies that manufactures and sells balloons, correct?
Yeah, that's right. This was a study that was part of them getting FDA approval to be able to use their device or to market their device for use in children.
So that explains the primary outcomes, which were toward more like safety and success with the procedure.
Right.
I mean, the other outcomes.
Right. The primary outcomes were technical success of whether you could deploy the balloon and successfully open it and close it and remove it. And then, were there any serious adverse events? So those are things that the FDA is interested in when they're trying to approve a device for use, which is very different than proving that it actually works, which is what you typically
see with
a medication trial.
Medication. Yeah, that's often confusing. I think these devices go through a different pathway in the FDA than medications go through. And medications, as it turns out, are much more heavily scrutinized with regard to efficacy. And you have to have very clear efficacy demonstration in order to get FDA approval. I think on the device side, they actually call it FDA clearance rather than approval. We as clinicians often call it approval, but it's really FDA clearance through this mechanism that devices go through. But I hear a lot of criticism about studies that are funded by the companies that are trying to sell these devices. So why should the listener trust the results of this study?
That's a good question. And I think it's worth sometimes just being transparent about what does it mean when a company funds a study like this. So for me, this is the first time that I have been involved as a PI in a study sponsored. So it was a learning experience for me as well. So essentially how this works is a company will have a contract, and in our case it would be with the department of the university, to be involved in this study. And essentially each patient that gets enrolled in the study, each visit, the university would get paid a specific amount of money, and when the procedure is done, they get paid a specific amount. It's actually very similar to reimbursement that comes through an insurance. And, the difference here is that this is not part of, your standard routine payer thing. So for the procedure, the patient actually doesn't pay anything. It's the company that pays for the procedure. So they're, as the investigator, when you're doing the procedure or the different surgeons that were involved, they get paid a certain amount for their time and experience to do the procedure, to do the clinic visits and the evaluations, et cetera. It ends up being very similar to what you might get paid from a third-party payer. That's very different than having a consulting arrangement with a company where they're actually paying you for your time. So for me personally, the company doesn't write me a check that I didn't take and put into my bank account. any payments go to the university, you know, and then of course that trickles down, however that does, but there's no sort of direct financial arrangement there. That being said, there is a financial arrangement, and obviously that's where, you know, you have to think about intentional or unintentional biases that can be involved in any study.
Right, right. Did you have an agreement with the company that you could publish the results as you interpreted them?
Yeah, so our policy in our department is that anytime we engage in a relationship, that we have them sign something that says that we have full editorial control over any publications that come out of it. So if the data looks terrible and reflects bad on the company, then we have the right to publish that data, regardless of whether they're happy with it or not, and to publish it however we want. So, you know, when I sat down to write this paper, I just wrote this paper, and, you know, I had my other co-authors look at it and a couple of other people outside just to make sure that it was reflected, but it wasn't something that I then sent to a company to edit, and then they put whatever spin on it that they want.
Sure, sure. No, it's all really good information, I think. I understand the criticisms that people levy at studies like this, but on the other hand, how are these technologies going to get developed without, you know, some kind of partnership with industry? And then number two, how are studies like this going to get funded so that we can evaluate the safety, so that we can evaluate potentially the effectiveness? How are they going to get funded without industry involvement? I mean, do you see other mechanisms for funding of studies like this?
I mean, there really isn't. I mean, there isn't easily available. I mean, this is not something that the NIH or something like that would have any interest in funding. They're much more interested in specific mechanistic things and things like that. So you're really left through this mechanism, and, you know, for good or bad. And if you think about it, if you were to try to do a study like this on your own, where you went to a patient and said, you know, we're going to offer this for free to you, that means you'd have to somehow purchase the equipment for free and the operating time and, you know, the anesthesiologists and all of the stuff that goes into it. It ends up being an enormous cost. And obviously the companies, it's an investment that they're trying to make to recoup in the future. But certainly if the study is negative, then it has huge financial ramifications as well.
Yeah, I think that's something that physicians really underestimate is the cost of doing studies like this, because the costs really add up quite quickly. These are quite expensive studies to do, and there's no way to just pull it off on a shoestring budget. You really need some real support to do something like this. Let's talk about the study a little bit, the strengths of the study. I like it because it focuses on peds, as we said, but it breaks it up into a 2 to 12-year-old group and the 12 and older group, which to me made a lot of sense because it seems like disease changes as we age, and you might be treating two different disease processes going on, at least two different disease processes going on here, just based on the age of the patients.
Exactly. I mean, there's the differences in, you know, our understanding of pathophysiology in kids versus adolescents or adults, and certainly the pathophysiology of sinusitis in children has been a lot less, you know, understudied compared to adults. But there's also just the anatomic differences between a 2 to 12-year-old and older when it comes to development of sphenoid and frontal sinuses specifically.
And then you use prospective data collection, and you use some validated instruments here that I think were useful. And if we look at the weaknesses of the study, I mean, I think the glaring weakness that people would bring up would be the lack of a control group, right?
Yeah. You know, this is a single-arm study, so you have it's prospective, so you have a baseline evaluation, you have the procedure done, and then you have follow-up evaluations up to 6 months. And showed that, if we focus on the quality of life improvements, it showed significant, statistically significant improvements and what we would call clinically relevant improvements, too. But what you don't know is that truly from the balloon sinus procedure that you did, or is it from something else? I mean, it could be that these kids were going to get better anyway. Maybe you enrolled them when they were very symptomatic and they were going to get better anyway with another course of antibiotics or what have you, and that's what you're seeing. Or maybe there's some sort of placebo effect or impact secondary gain type thing where everybody wants to feel like the surgery helped them, and that's what you're seeing built in. And without a control group, you can't know that. And certainly without a randomized control group, you can't prove it for certain.
The procedures that were performed, the balloon dilation procedures, I assume that the maxillary sinus was targeted primarily. Were other sinuses targeted as well?
Yes. The majority of children had their maxillary sinus balloon, but there were other sinuses as well, and that was somewhat dependent on the age. So children over 12 could have had frontal or sphenoid done if that was felt to be necessary, whereas those less than 12 was only maxillary. An interesting thing to talk about is that in 60% of instances, other procedures were done at the same time. And the most common of that was an adenoidectomy, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Most of the sort of standard protocols that we learn are that initially you would think about doing an adenoidectomy first, and if that fails, then you consider something else. So in 50% of the time, roughly, an adenoidectomy was done at the same time, and there was 40% of children enrolled where it was only the balloon that was done.
Made me wonder if we couldn't design a study where we randomized kids to either an adenoidectomy or a balloon. What would you think about that design?
That would be an interesting design. I guess for me, you know, there's pretty good data that an adenoidectomy seems to work, and just doing a balloon and not addressing the adenoid. In some ways, to me, there's kind of two different questions. There's the question of, let's say a six-year-old who has chronic sinusitis and is now... Do you just take their adenoid out, or would you do an adenoidectomy plus a focused balloon procedure? That's kind of one question. That's one where you potentially could randomize a child to adenoidectomy or adenoidectomy plus balloon. Does the balloon give you some additional benefit above and beyond? And then the second one is in children who've already had an adenoidectomy and have failed that, and there's a small group that does, then is the balloon your next go-to, or is that an option in the future? In this particular study, we did separate the data, and we did look at those 40% of kids who only had the balloon done, and their quality of life outcomes were similar to the group that had adjunct procedures done at the same time. But I think, just to kind of belabor this, because I think it's a really important point, is that 60% of these kids were felt by the surgeon to need something else in addition to balloon, whether that was an adenoidectomy or whatever. So I think what it means is that you need to be very thoughtful. 6 out of 10, you're probably going to consider some other adjunctive procedure that needs to happen at the same time, and maybe there's a group of kids who've already had their adenoid removed or whatever where just doing the balloon makes sense. But this data doesn't say you can just balloon everybody and not worry about anything else and they're all going to get better.
What are the major takeaways from this study, Zach? And follow up to that, how has it changed your practice? How would this study have altered your practice?
The main take home is that it appears to be technically feasible, and that it's at least in experienced and thoughtful hands, it's a safe procedure. That's the first take home. The second is that the kids do seem to have improvements in quality of life. So there's smoke there that the balloon does appear to potentially have efficacy. What we don't know is, you know, how this would compare to a control group. And I think that's probably the next series of studies. And if you look at the adults, you know, it started where we had, if you just think of traditional sinus surgery, initial studies were uncontrolled and they were single institution, then they became multi-institution and using nice prospective validated outcomes. And then you had incorporation of control groups so you could really compare. And I think that's probably the next phase here would be to incorporate a control group so that you can see if this adds additional benefit. And then it starts getting into nuanced questions like you talked about, is does this add anything to adenoid, or should you just be doing adenoid first? And how does it compare to a traditional sinus surgery? I do think that it offers less invasiveness, probably an easier recovery time and things like that. So there's some options where it makes sense in a pediatric population where you can't necessarily do good postoperative debridements and follow them as close as you have in adults, where it just seems to make sense that it's going to fit in somewhere on some level. And the question is where and to what degree, I think.
Has this study altered your approach, or is it just still too early? We need some more information.
For me, it takes me a while to kind of change things. I guess I'm in the, you know, if we just took your average, let's say, 6-year-old with chronic sinusitis, I'm probably going to think of doing an adenoidectomy first. And when those kids fail, then, or if those kids fail, then, and they had primarily maxillary disease, then that's probably, I think, a balloon procedure might fit into my regimen before I went to a more traditional sinus surgery. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, my practice as a rhinologist is a little bit more skewed, so I see a lot of cystic fibrosis and a lot of inflammatory. The children I see are often older with severe asthma and pansinusitis, so those are the type of kids that it may not necessarily make sense for.
I always struggle with this just because I feel like, you know, as I think about the pathophysiology of chronic rhinosinusitis, I think so much about the ethmoids and the importance of addressing ethmoid disease. And so I wonder, or I have trouble sometimes, I guess, reconciling that. How do you go in and just address the maxillary sinus without really addressing the ethmoids? I guess you could make the argument that you're addressing the ethmoid infundibulum because it, by definition, has to be dilated to some degree in order to dilate the maxillary sinus. What are your thoughts on that?
You mean you can make an argument that this is my gestalt here, that a lot of pediatric sinus surgery ends up being relatively limited where you're doing max OMC surgery, you know, maxillary and anteroethmoid. I'm not so sure that anteroethmoid is adding that much to that particular mm-hmm. procedure. I think the bang for the buck is really removing, you know, is opening that ethmoid infundibular space. I'm always humbled when I go back and look at children who've had that procedure at a young age, and you go back and look there, and it's hard to control that healing process. You see scarring. It's not necessarily that huge, wide-open maxillary that you have in the adult population. I feel like, you know, there's maybe an, it makes sense on there's an area there where it's going to be a useful thing. And, you know, from another standpoint, I'm a parent, so I have young kids. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And for me, if they had very isolated maxillary disease, it seems like a pretty attractive option to go and mm-hmm. do a balloon, and they have very little bleeding and recovery and versus a more traditional sinus surgery. But obviously, that's hopefully the data will show us as time goes on.
It's a really good point. It's interesting you brought that up because I'm a parent as well of young monsters. And just thinking about that from a parent's perspective, I was thinking about having these types of options available to us. So, well, Zach, really appreciate the work that you've done. Congratulations on it. I look forward to it coming into print here in the next few months. And I hope the listeners will take a look at it online in the meantime. And maybe you and I will be able to get together on the podcast in the future and talk about the follow-up study.
All right. Sounds good, Tim. I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or the sponsors.